Indeed. So thanks so much. Thanks for the kind invitation. And thanks to the organizers for all the effort and sweat of setting up this wonderful workshop. Now, unsurprisingly, given the theme of this workshop, this talk will be about equilibration and thermalization of quantum many-body systems out of equilibrium. But then, given that we are at the Parameter Institute, I thought it would be fun to give the talk a bit of a quantum information flavor by putting a bit of an emphasis on the quantum simulation side of things. That is to say, we're not only interested in seeing what we do know about equilibration and thermalization, but also what we do not know about equilibration and thermalization, as in the mindset of a quantum simulation, that's rather good news than bad news, in that there's good hope that we can actually go into the lab and probe these unresolved questions under precisely controlled conditions. So, as such, this talk will have a bit of a review component, then we meander through the theme, and there will be usual suspects of Eugene and also Marcus themes popping up all over the place. I hope this will not become too superficial. Okay, so it's an early talk. Maybe it doesn't hurt too much to remind ourselves quickly what we think that a quantum simulator actually is. So, in one way or the other, a quantum... Oh. So much about... Oh, that's bad. Okay, one way or the other, a quantum simulator is about learning some interesting property of some interesting complex quantum system. So instead of trying to go into your office and trying to solve that system on your desktop classical computer, as we heard beautifully in Marcus' talk just a second ago, one goes into the lab and tries to simulate that quantum system with another quantum system under precisely controlled conditions. So that could be, say, a ground state property of a local Hamiltonian system in the condensed matter context. And then property would usually mean some expectation value, like some order parameter in one way or the other. But that's not the only flavor we can think of a quantum simulator. We can also think of the dynamical reading of a quantum simulator related to some dynamical feature, meaning some property that pops up in the course of time evolution, quite in the spirit of this workshop, obviously. Now, this comes in two flavors. Again, the one flavor is kind of the digital flavor, in which one makes use of some variant of a Trotter formula, and one sets up a suitable quantum circuit that approximates the time evolution in some sort of stroboscopic fashion in this kind of Seth Lloyd Feynman-esque idea. The good news about this is that this is a mindset of quantum simulation that very much allows for quantum error correction and fully-fledged simulation in one way or the other. Yet, of course, this is experimenting an excessively difficult prescription, actually one that is very similar to a fully-fledged universal quantum computer. Now, the next flavor is a more daring flavor, where one goes into the lab and tries to mimic the interacting many-body Hamiltonian under precisely controlled conditions, kind of sets it up there in the lab and just lets it go freely in time and evolve in time and measures and probes stuff at later times and estimates properties of time evolution later. And that's the type of analog quantum simulator that will be kind of the motivating theme, if you want, of this talk, although we very much relate to the themes of Marcus in many ways. Now, there's two obvious questions that pop up in the course of this. First of all, well, you can do all kinds of quantum simulations of a proof of principle type, and that's very fun and great to do. Yet, there's obviously most point to the idea of a quantum simulator if you do something in the lab that you cannot do otherwise, in a way that you outperform classical computers. So in the best of all worlds, that would be related to some sort of complexity class of computer science that you solve a hard problem in a way, but surely you would like to know that your quantum simulator should solve a problem that is hard or classically inaccessible. Your guy should be more powerful than your desktop classical computer, although you can do pretty well, as we heard in Marcus' talk. Or at least you would like to have good reasons to believe that this is the case. Now, this is a much less straightforward point than one might believe in the first place. So a bit in quantum information jargon, Well, full quantum error correction in such a setting seems out of scope. So is that going to be a problem? So do errors accumulate in time and kind of make it break? Or are you interested anyway in robust features so the errors that accumulate are not really much of a problem because one is interested in robust features anyway? Or devices like with full error correction are presumably not be complete, meaning not universal quantum computers, but presumably they're also more powerful than classical computers. So how powerful are such devices in the lab after all? And there seems to be a bit of clash of civilizations here in that in physics, these analog simulators are there to stay for good reasons because, well, frankly, there are those quantum simulators that you can actually do with present technology. At the same time, computer scientists don't like these things so much, and there's very little known on understanding what the computational power of actual devices of that kind is. But it would be nice to know that it would even be fun to think of like complexity classes of analog quantum simulators assessing what they can do. But anyway, let's assume we have such a device. We go into the lab and we have an interesting thing sitting there and we have done an experiment. We do it and we measure and the outcome is 5 or 10, whatever. I mean, how do we know whether it's correct? And that relates to the certification problem. I mean, how would we know whether we have done the right thing? And that's not so easy because it's a hard problem in the first place. And that's also not an NP problem in the language of computer science. So how would we know that the quantum simulator is doing that we think it is doing? Or at least we should have good reasons to believe that this is the case. And clearly these are kind of almost two sides of the same coin, which are rather intertwined. Not that I'm going to give an answer to that question, but that's kind of the motivating question for the mindset of quantum simulation. Concerning the physics questions that are being probed, they are very much those questions that are in the center, in the focus of what we are concerned with in this workshop. So these questions of how systems, specifically quantum many-body systems, come to equilibrium. So how do they come to rest once pushed out of equilibrium, and how do features like temperature, Gibbs ensembles, or so dynamically emerge? It's clear, say, how to capture maximum entropy states in quantum statistical mechanics, but it seems much less clear how these maximum entropy states would kind of dynamically pop up through interacting many-body evolution. Or how can one think of systems going from one quantum phase literally to another? Yeah.
Can I ask that? This specification, suppose you have like a nearest neighbor Ising model, you can do high temperature expansion very easily.
Yeah.
According to this specification, is it an NP-hard problem or not? Or how this hardness changes with temperature?
That's a long question. I mean, the short answer is whenever a system is like, well, not only integrable, but like a free model or so, of course you can give.
I'm talking about interacting.
Ah.
It's high temperature expansion fully interacting, but.
Yeah. That's an interesting question. I give the proper answer at the end, if I may. But the short answer is the first answer that says, I do not know. Second, of course, a lot is known about hardness of ground state features. Like to find ground states of many-body Hamiltonians can be very hard. In fact, harder than NP problems. It's like harder than factoring numbers that your internet security is based on. It's like not even a quantum computer could find some ground states. It's kind of QMA complete, as one says. So that's quite established and much known. That's a nice link to physics of disorder and Anglasi systems. That's for ground states. For thermal states, it's not so easy. That we have a result on like high temperature states where things are in P efficient, but there's a big gray region in between. They are neither in P, not like you cannot do it classically efficiently, nor kind of hard in a sense. So the extreme points are there in the middle. I don't know, but it's a good question. But there's more to say at the end. But we kind of switch minds, so we are back into the kind of more physics-y questions. So questions of equilibration, thermalization, how can systems go from one phase to another? Obviously, these are very old questions indeed. as old as quantum mechanics. Wigner was mentioned earlier, but also the Pauli paper mentions many interesting questions already in the 30s and gives the right intuition. At the same time, it seems fair to say that now there are new mathematical methods available, like typicality, concentration of measure, Lie Robertson bounds, and so on. New numerical techniques, the flavor of tensor network methods, and new experiments in the flavor of quantum simulations, which are, I guess, the point why we are having this workshop. Now, the physical systems that we have in mind are systems of cold atoms in optical lattices, which are artificial lattices made from counterpropagating laser light. So if you put in cold atoms there, the atoms would feel a Stark shift and would like to sit in the potential minima. It's really like a condensed matter lattice system under precisely controlled conditions in the lab. Now, the plain vanilla Hamiltonian that comes out if one throws cold atoms into such a kind of artificial egg carton, so to say, is the so-called Bose-Hubbard Hamiltonian that captures both hopping from one side to another and interactions on the sides. But it should be clear that by changing the lattice depth, by making use of superlattices, Feshbach resonances, or so, or time-dependent driving, one can largely tune the Hamiltonians to your desire and really set up the quantum simulator in the way you would like to have it in the lab and under controlled conditions. Now, the physics questions that we have in mind are of the type that we have seen already and we'll see several times from now on. Surely, we have seen it in Marcus' talk, we will see it in Leah's talk, found it in Eugene's talk. Say, that's the paradigm of a sudden quench, where we just think of some having some initial state given, say with clustering of correlations that's sitting there, and then you suddenly and quickly change the system parameters to a new Hamiltonian and let the system evolve under that new Hamiltonian for longer and longer times, forever and ever. For example, you quench from the deep mod phase to the deep superfluid phase and let it just go in time. What happens? So does it equilibrate? That seems far from clear. After all, this was a closed many-body system, so if the entropy is zero initially, it will stay zero for all time. So in what way can you think of systems actually equilibrating? Does it thermalize, or do properties of Gibbs states emerge in one way or the other? We'll see. That's the one setting, that's the sudden quench setting. The next setting that we have a look at will be related to slow quenches, or like slower quenches, where we think of having some affine family of Hamiltonians with a knob, where you just slowly change the parameters of the model and see what happens. Now, if you are in a gap phase, by virtue of the adiabatic theorem, one should expect that the many-body system should pretty much follow the approximate ground state at all times. So you can really literally walk the phase diagram and kind of go everywhere within the gapped phase if you are slow enough. Yet, if you come close to a second-order phase transition, the gap will be closing down, and you have to become slower and slower. So, but at some point, you can never be slow enough. So how can you ever get across? So how can a literal phase transition happen? And that's kind of the second question that we will have a look at in the rest of this talk. So how much time do I have? It's like an hour minus 5 minutes. Okay, so questions of equilibration and thermalization, very much related to what we just heard in Marcus' talk. So again, think of having some initial state given with clustering correlations, say a product state or some like ground state of a local Hamiltonian. You suddenly and quickly change the Hamiltonian to a new local Hamiltonian and let the system evolve in time under that Hamiltonian. Does it equilibrate? Well, it does. In fact, it nicely and smoothly equilibrates. Of course, not the entire system can equilibrate. It's a closed system after all, as also Marcus pointed out. But what can be true And this is, in fact, what generically is the case, that it, for many observables, looks perfectly as if it had equilibrated. Yeah, so whenever you look, and that's specifically true for local observables, meaning if you make a local observation, you would just find values that are wobble, 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 wobble initially, and then it looks perfectly as if it had equilibrated to an apparent equilibrium state, which in fact turns out to be the infinite time average, that has to be that, which in turn turns out to be the maximum entropy state given all, that is to say, exponentially many constants of motion. And that's not put in, that's kind of, that comes out. This is like a dynamical change principle where you would have some initial dynamics, some whatever, non-equilibrium stuff going on, but then whenever you measure, you would take the value as if the system had gone to the maximum entropy state given all constants of motion. And this is generically what happens in such systems. Now, this can be true in a number of ways. I mentioned two of them. And as often in physics, one can say a lot about little and little about a lot. So the first thing is saying a lot about, never mind. I think a lot about little. Yeah. Well, jet lag sets in. So this is the setting that's true for a very large class of initial states. You just have some state given that has a very mild decay of correlations in the lattice. The correlation functions should decay like 1 over the distance squared in the lattice, like very mild decay, including, say, critical models. It's very general. Yet the class of Hamiltonians is very special. Namely, it's a free or super integrable bosonic or fermionic model. Yeah. But for those models, you can say everything. I think Marcus mentioned that in his talk or so. Also, in the sense that you can give me an arbitrary error, epsilon, and an arbitrary recurrence time, and I find you a system size such that from this initial relaxation time on, T1, up to arbitrary long later, T2, the local system would look in one norm exactly like the time average. Yeah. So for arbitrarily long, the system would look perfectly relaxed. That's just a fanciful way of saying that all expectation values would take the same value as if you had done a measurement on the maximum entropy state. So for as long as you want, the system would perfectly equilibrate it if the system size is long enough. So an error 10 to the power of minus 17, 10 years, you can have the system, there's wobble, 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 there's some initial dynamics from a certain time on until arbitrarily long later, the system would perfectly relax. So how can that, yes? Ah, that's good. What state is that? Or the headline gives it away. It's the maximum entropy state given all constant motion. That's always the case. But here is also the maximum entropy state given the linearly many constants of motion, which Marcus would also call the generalized Gibbs ensemble. Oh, slide is not. Yeah, there's some past. It's the generalized Gibbs ensemble, meaning it's the Gaussian state given the covariance matrix, which is to say it's a proven instance of a convergence to the so-called generalized Gibbs ensemble. It's as Gibbsian as it gets, but it's an integrable model, so it's not quite Gibbsian. Yeah? That's a rigorous proof. It's a monster of a proof. It's like a 20 pages monster, yet the intuition is actually quite simple. There's a couple of ingredients coming in. The one is like a light cone dynamics Lieb-Robinson intuition that I think Fabian will mention a lot in his talk. That's the one ingredient. The other ingredient is somehow that you chuck the lattice into parts where some parts take the role of like random variables, and there are corridors that take the room of the role of spaces, and then one does a kind of Bernstein-Bohn blocking argument that the variables become like not identically distributed but independent, and one can cook up a non-commutative central limit theorem showing that the states become Gaussian given the constant of motion. That's kind of the high-level blah blah version of the proof, although the details are rather involved. We did this for bosons some years ago already. That's the quantum version of the Spohn argument for classical systems. You're just writing up the fermionic version thereof that relates again to Fabian's work, which has a neat non-commutative central limit theorem in Grassmann variables. So if interested, I can show you. Yes? Ah, indeed. Yes, indeed, that's a good point. What is the T2? It just scales linearly. I mean, the proof is complicated, but the intuition is you hammer here, there will be a Lie Robinson velocity. The T2 time is when the excitation sees itself. And indeed, it grows linearly with the system size. You want to have, instead of 10 years, 20 years, double the system size. You're absolutely right. Yeah?
Then would P depends to if you're considering the binary interaction or short-range interaction in your system or not?
Oh, yeah, that's short-range, indeed. Local, finite range. Long range is an interesting topic in its own right that we looked at quite a bit with also Michael Kastner and so on, these ion trap things where you have power law decays. Everything is different. If you're interested, even causality breaks down and you get all kinds of funny effects in these long range models. Pretty interesting, but for other reasons. I talk about too many things already, so I didn't want to put that in as well. Yeah, but you're right. It's local. So this is like saying a lot about little, you can now say little about a lot, meaning all Hamiltonians with non-degenerate energy gaps. If you're not interested in any time scale, but just want to know, do systems in expectation equilibrate? You can have such a statement here, where you just ask, how does the expected deviation in time look like? And you have this bound on the right-hand side, where this effective dimension is essentially the overlap of the initial state with the many-body eigenvectors, and since the spectrum is exponentially dense, that quantity is usually exponentially large, which means this is exponentially small, which means that for the overwhelming majority in time, the system looks perfectly equilibrated to overwhelming precision, except you have no clue when this happens. Yeah. So besides, the time average could mean that you have to average for very long times. So it could stay very non-typical for very long times, and only for super exponentially large time look typical. So that's a very general statement, but it's a bit unsatisfactory in the sense you have no information about time scales whatsoever, and it could take like extremely long before the stuff that you expect actually sets in. Lesson: systems generically appear relaxed. You quench a many-body system, although the dynamics is entirely unitary. That's not a contradiction. Systems can appear relaxed, although they are closed system dynamics. That's proven in the strong sense for general states in the integrable limit for the Bose-Harvard model. It's true in a slightly weaker sense generically, in the sense of an expectation. But nothing is known about timescales. Well, nothing is a bit of an over-exaggeration, but too little is known about timescales in non-integrable model, in local models. So how long does it take to equilibrate? Well, it's an interesting open question. And it's not even fully known whether expectation values would decay exponentially or algebraically with time in non-interacting models. So even there are open questions sitting around. So one should expect equilibration to the time average, but the time scale question is wide open, although I shouldn't say that nothing is known, because there's some islet of knowledge, but the time scale question as such is still rather open. When do systems thermalize? Am I speaking too quickly? I have a bit of a tendency of speaking rather quickly. Should I kind of, there's a knob, right? Okay, good. So when the systems thermalize, in addition on appearing equilibrated, looking thermal. So do Gibbs states emerge? Does it look temperature-like? Or more precisely, do local expectation values take the value as if the entire system had been prepared in a Gibbs state? So it looks like the reduction of a global Gibbs state. That's a complicated question with many, like everybody in the audience has already worked on that. You need like subsystem state independence, unique bath state dependence. In one way or the other, you have to have that the Gibbs weights pop up in one way or the other. Well, that's a complicated question. There is a lot to say about this, but because I promised to put an emphasis on this simulation aspect, I will not, but I will just give some intuition, and then we move on. Like, roughly speaking, there's two avenues towards actually proving thermalization in many body models. The one thing is related, well, Marcus showed that already briefly in his talk, to making assumptions about the individual many-body eigenstates as such. There's many readings of the so-called eigenstate thermalization hypothesis. Like one reading is that individual eigenstates locally already look as if the entire system had been in the Gibbs state of the respective temperature. And based on that, one can indeed prove thermalization, but one has to show that the eigenstate thermalization hypothesis is true in the first place, which may or may not be the case. That's an interesting open question in its own right. What has been our approach over the last years is more, is a bit making weaker assumptions in that one only asks about certain assumptions about the overlap of the initial state with respective energy eigenstates, and then try to show that then one can prove thermalization based on that assumption. And that's a program that we've been trying to do for a while, and we have respectable progress, although the full question is still open. I give an example statement of such a kind that one can cook up. That's true in one-dimensional quantum system under translationally invariant Hamiltonians, where one can find that initial states with a flat energy distribution in a microcanonical energy window, they would locally equilibrate towards a Gibbs state, even if they're initially far from equilibrium. Yeah, and that's a statement, again, on the one norm of a reduced state of the global Gibbs state compared to the time average, where one can make reasonable bounds on the right-hand side. And this is true both in the kinematic reading, meaning I draw Hall measure random states from this microcanonical window. Does that look thermal for the overwhelming majority? That's a kind of typicality, Goldstein-esque reading. That's kind of the Goldstein program in the presence of interaction. Yes, that can be shown. And also in the dynamical reading, meaning one prepares a state in any state that has only support on this microcanonical energy window, you just let it go, and then you show that at later times, it will look as if the system had perfectly thermalized. Yes?
Why is dimensionality
entering this? This is like, my slide is very blah, blah. This actually is true for any dimension. It's just more interesting in one dimension. In higher dimensions, you would have to assume that you have a unique Gibbs state. That's not necessarily the case in Whitehandy. And you need exponential clustering of correlations. For high temperatures, that's always the case. For low temperatures, that may not be the case. Like even, I mean, you know that that's not even a unique Gibbs state. Also, the bounds are a bit awkward. There's a kind of, it's in a way extensive in a certain boundary that you single out. The bounds are much worse in more than 1D. It's, strictly speaking, a general statement, but it's awkward in more than 1D. Yeah. It's only local and translation invariant, but it's only true for certain, you have to be in the bulk of the spectrum. So it's kind of a high temperature limit, but there's no assumption on the Hamiltonian. It's translation invariant, or not ordered in 1D. So this is respectable progress, yet it's not really what one wants. As you ask, I mean, you want to have a good bound, a good statement in higher dimensions. Also, you would really want to have that you prepare a state and you quench to a new Hamiltonian, and you would like to know that this preparation leads to a thermal effect, right? That's what you want, and not these very specific preparations. We know that the energy windows are very narrow. Marcus mentioned that, and you might mention that, this kind of 1 over square root of n thing, but this is a very special distribution. So this is known, but a lot of stuff is not known, and the full Monty of preparing like a Bose-Hubbard Hamiltonian quenching, show that you thermalize, there's a long way to go still. So lesson, very weakly coupled systems with narrow energy distribution can be expected to thermalize. In fact, that they are provably doing that in some settings. But, well, the full question is far from known. The equilibration is pretty well known. The thermalization question is in many ways still rather open. One can also find conditions for non-thermalizing. Not in the sense of solving a model and showing something, but rather can I find conditions such that if they're satisfied, we know that the system will not thermalize because there's too much of a memory of the initial condition. And this can be done, like if the effective entanglement in the eigenbasis, that's one of these conditions, is small, then one could let the system go, But there will always be a memory of the initial condition that one has prepared the system in, but that's illegal because it should thermalize. It should not remember where it came from. So this, and then the misery is put to showing that this condition is satisfied. That's found to be present in many body localized models. In fact, this condition is rather similar to what Bela Bauer and Chaitan Nayak recently formulated as a condition for many body localization. But it's far less clear how that can be realized in a robust way in many body translation variant models. So there's some candidates that we have, but to cook up such a statement in a robust translation variant way seems tricky, and I think Matthew Fisher will give a talk about that. I'm quite keen what he's going to say on like localization in translation invariant models. So lesson, some things are known. One can expect models to thermalize generically in the non-integrable setting, yet many questions are very wide open. 30 minutes into the talk, that's good. So let's switch hats and forget about what we said. So some things are known, some things are not known. So let's go into the lab and probe those questions that are not known. Okay, so mathematical physics hat off, experimental physics hat on. So the quench that we talked about, like a quench from a strongly correlated Bose-Haber-Hamiltonian, say from the Mott to deep superfluid phase, that's something that you can do in the lab by changing the depth of the optical lattice. Very good, you can do that. Only that at the time when this first experiment was done, it was not so easy to probe single side properties. But I've been talking about local relaxation all the time. So it's a bit ironic that you can think of local relaxation. You can do the experiment, but you cannot so easily find out whether what you've done is the right thing because you cannot so easily locally measure the system. But who says that your local system is consecutive sites in the lattice? You can also think of a periodic two setting, A, B, A, B, A, B, A, B, and take all A sites to be your subsystem and the B sites to be the rest, the other part of the system. And Marcus was already kind enough to mention that in his talk. This can be done. You can think of a charge density wave type initial states, atom nothing, atom nothing, atom nothing. Then you quench to the full many-body Hamiltonian, let it evolve, and then you ramp up the lattice, and then you can measure all kinds of properties of densities, correlators, currents, and so on, sophisticated stuff, but with period two. So with period two, you can essentially measure everything, but that's the setting that you have. And there's a lot to say about this. That's really a scheme where one can probe in time these questions and measure things in the lab under very precisely controlled conditions. But for the purposes of this talk, to keep in time, I would rather single out one plot and make a point that you might or might not buy. And that's this figure here, okay? That shows the, in fact, Marcus has shown it already. That shows the density of odd sites as a function of time in the experiment. So the dots are the experiments as a function of time, so you prepare it. Initially, there are no particles at odd sites. And then there's a complicated non-equilibrium dynamics. And for very long times, you just have half a particle per site. That's the obvious equilibrium value. And in the middle, you have a complicated non-equilibrium dynamics. Okay? That's what you do, and you can do that in the very nicely time-resolved fashion and so on. Okay? That was done in Emanuel Bloch's lab. We did numerical support work of that. In fact, not just some numerics, but what we did is we took, well, the best known code to date on keeping track of one-dimensional time evolution. It's a variant of a TMIG code. It was run in Jülich, which is the fastest computer the German taxpayer can afford, with 5 weeks of running time, which is the longest time you can afford to have a publishable result per plot. So this is kind of pushing it to the publication limit, so to say. That's as much classical numerics you can do. And that's the blue curve that shows with no fitting, but that's a fitting-free resimulation on a classical computer of the same experiment, and it seems fair to say that it seems very similar. You can really resimulate that experiment. How many atoms? Oh, it's 10 to the power of 5 atoms, roughly speaking. It's essentially a three-dimensional system with effective one-dimensional wires, and it's resampling that. Oh, it's like 100. Yeah? But there's some fine print I keep short. It's a three-dimensional setting. Let's discuss that later. Yeah? But there's no fitting. It's not fitting that, but we make use of the geometry, but other than that, it's fine. Yeah. Sorry?
My impression from the paper was that average is 30 atoms per cube.
Oh, no, it's like half of it. It's like in total, it's like 80 or so. It's about an order of magnitude of 100 in the experiment. Yeah. So this is this setting. So for short times, you can really do that. And in fact, this is essentially true to machine precision, right? You can run that with a 5,000 by 5,000 matrix product bond dimension. This is practically true to machine precision. If you put the mathematical physics hat on using Lee-Robinson bounds, you can really find the error bar that you can have for short times. So for short times, you can really keep track of strongly correlated dynamics up to the level of a theorem. You can do it, until you hit a boundary where you can no longer go any further because of the growth of entanglement. Rennie entanglement entropies will grow in time, linearly in time, which means that you need an exponentially large bond dimension to faithfully approximate the state at a given instance of time, again related to the slight cone dynamics. So while for short times you can essentially do it to machine precision, there's no way you can even approximate the state with any matrix product state, let alone do this on a computer, because there's an exponential blow up of the bond dimension. So there's no way you can keep track of long time dynamics on any of these classical supercomputers. Having said that, it's getting brighter, no? Is that light? Having said that,
somebody disagrees with your statement.
Maybe. Okay, yeah. Okay. But the thing is, to make my point, the experiment runs on, right? There's a certain boundary, and the experiment runs on. So how would nature care what we think is doable on a classical computer? So you can like estimate properties, say whether it relaxes exponentially or algebraically in time, but better based on the quantum data than on the classical simulation that's rather used to certify that you have done the right thing in the lab. So you can build trust in the functioning of the device for short times, but then you can probe long-time dynamics in the lab under precisely controlled conditions, but better based on the quantum data than on the classical data that you have. So in this sense, I mean, it's a baby step, but it's a baby step in the right direction that in this sense it, well, outperforms the best available classical simulation on supercomputers that's done to find out that you've done the right thing with like weeks of running time on the fastest computer, to a certain point to find out that the device is doing the right thing, but then you can quantum simulate properties at later times that seem inaccessible on classical supercomputers. So these are cut short. There's also thermalization that can be asked, but well, that's compatible with thermalization. Lesson, cold atoms quantum simulators allow to probe non-equilibrium features that presumably cannot classically be computed. It's a baby step in this direction, but I would say that it's a baby step in the right direction, in that quantum many-body systems in non-equilibrium are the right candidates to think of quantum devices that outperform classical computers, because, well, small systems can always be classically simulated, and also ground state properties, as Marcus very nicely said, if you could do Monte Carlo, you're pretty much in business. So quantum many-body dynamics is the right space to look for devices that do something in the lab that you cannot do on a classical computer efficiently. Okay, let me come to the last bit. I have one more bit and a bit of a provocation, but the provocation is a bit of a more of a quantum information type. I might still make it. Well, judge for yourself, yeah? This is the puzzle of slow quenches, okay? So assume that you have a gap phase and you can walk the phase diagram by slowly changing the system parameters. The adiabatic theorem ensures equilibration. You can really walk a gap phase and stay close to the ground state at respective times. Except that if you come close to a critical point, the gap will be closing down. And no slow will be slow enough because, well, you have to slow down very much. So how can you ever get across? Now, this is a problem, again, with a huge history in literature. There's one beautiful and very simple, very crude, basic picture that explains what's going on. That just says, okay, you quench through a phase transition, you will be adiabatic for most of the time. Until you hit the point where the adiabatic theorem is no longer satisfied. And then you are reaching a regime that you call diabatic, or not adiabatic, the frozen, the sudden regime. Yeah, and then there might be another adiabatic regime. Now this point where you hit the validity boundary of the adiabatic theorem, that's related to a gap, which is related to a length scale. And if you plug that into the theory of critical exponents, you get scaling laws out, like the power law scaling laws for the correlation length as a function of the quench time. That's called the Kibble-Zurich mechanism. It's a very beautiful setting that explains in one sentence what's going on. You have a power law coming out through just hitting the boundary of the validity of the adiabatic theory. Really? Where? Oh, sorry. Yes, indeed. Okay. Thanks. Okay. So this is a very beautiful picture. It very nicely explains what's going on. But in some sense, it's also a bit too crude. I mean, take 10 people in the room and they will fiercely disagree on what's going on. I mean, I made statistical empirics on that. There's a huge literature, but there's also not a complete understanding of what's going on, it seems fair to say. And I hope the following also seems fair to say, that often in physics you have this hierarchy of levels, description levels. At the top, somebody has a really cool idea like Kibble-Zurich. The next level is a bit of a more physicalization of what's going on, you have more examples and so on, then it triples down to the point where somebody writes a C-star algebraic paper in communications and mathematical physics, which is 50 pages long, and nailed it down with all rigor of mathematical physics once and for all, with 7 citations in the entire lifetime of the paper. Yeah? That's a common way physics functions. Here, this hierarchy stops very high up. In the sense, it's not so easy to fill these notions with meat. I hope this is fair to say. Please disagree if you want. Yeah, in the sense that, of course, you can. This is a very nice description, but it's very hard to fill, for example, this frozen regime with meat. What is surely not true is what people often say is that expectation values of local observers, they will not be time independent. In fact, they will wobble like crazy in time. What is also not true, a bit more sophisticatedly, is that the overlap with the final state will not depend on time in the frozen regime. In fact, if it changes very much in exactly the regime where it should be frozen. Yes?
In fact, Mike, there were several papers, including one by Nusche, which showed that standard scaling theory applies here and works very well. So as long as you understand scaling theory of equilibrium phase transition.
Ah, very good. So that proves 2 points. First, that you have 10 people in the room, that there's 10 opinions. I say that it's a huge literature. It actually is interesting because there's a number of approaches, there's many approaches to that problem, but they are in a way giving similar predictions, but they're mathematically inequivalent. For example, if you have a free model, you can go to a collection of Landau-Zener problems and then solve the problem, you get power loss, and that's very beautiful. You can think, and that's also related to your work, one can do adiabatic perturbation theory that's mathematically different, but gives rise to similar results. You can do kind of truncated Wigner type approaches, and then you get a scaling collapse, but then again you get power loss, but for different reasons, namely that you have a symmetry in your equations of motion describing the model. So to cut a long story short, there are different approaches that lead to similar predictions. Yeah, and well, I tend to disagree, but we agree.
I touch on another problem with that. You try doing anything on real Hubbard model, you see that you're dominated by excitation at the edge of the real and zone, which have high density of state.
Oh, indeed.
So you see power law, you have to go so slowly that it's not possible experimentally.
Ah, very good. Also, there's a causally slowest point in 1D. That's a good point. But that's a point also here that. Let's take it for granted. Let's take the mindset that is perfectly understood if you're slow enough and if transition happens very similar, very close to a phase transition. How close is close to a phase transition? Yeah, that's another issue. In retrospect, oh, am I already out of time? No.
Yeah.
Yeah.
To me, the picture is very clear. It's not like you say, as far as I understand, it's really sitting here, and there is a very sharp point. There is a Ginsburg criterion which tells you how close you have to be to the phase transition. And the Ginsburg criterion now is framed in terms of the, how strong, how fast you quench, but there is a very clear. So there is a regime where you're non-universal and basically you're dominated by what's happening at the cutoff scale. And there is a regime where the scaling works. And as far as I understand, it's really, really scaling.
Okay, but it's more than the cutoff, it's diverging density of states.
Yeah.
That makes it much worse.
Yeah.
Okay, so that means that the perturbative result becomes even, has a very large non-universal prefactor.
Yeah, indeed. So I agree with all, but already we have like four opinions. I should rather come to my point, right? The thing is that you see what I mean. It's not so clear what's going on. It is a good regime again to go into the lab and see what's going on in the lab under precisely controlled conditions. Yeah, so that relates to an experiment that Uli Schneider has done and Emanuel Bloch on a slow quench, where using Feshbach resonance and atomic MOT insulator was initially prepared, and then a approximately linear quench through the phase transition was being done, was monitored as a function of time, and then the scaling law as a function of the quench time was monitored. That's the experiment. For the numerics, we did heavy numerics on DMRG and exact diarization in 1D, where one exactly finds out what and why and when things are happening, and the agreement between the, and if you spend a year on all the fine print, on the effect of the trap, on mass transport, on in what sense dephasing matters, and so on. So there's a kind of 20 pages appendix on what possible influences of stuff could go on. So, in fact, I'm not making any claim on what's going on. I'm just saying we just go into the lab and measure what's going on and support that, right? And one can do that and one finds an excellent agreement between the data and the numerics.
Yeah, exactly. I was going to say, this is really, if you want to understand the scaling theory, then how can you do it with some such small simulations and small system sizes?
Okay, so this is the indeed. Okay, I'm 47 into the thing. This 15 site thing, there's a lot to say. I mean, this is a huge project. This 15 site is like the exact diagonalization statement. Of course, the DMRG is like effectively infinite size. The thing here is that while we compare all these different methods and cross checked, if you have to do exact diagonalization, you find that for many regimes, 15 sites are already pretty good for the reason that the correlation length that you end up is short and you get really a truncation error through Lee-Robertson bounds that you know how good you are for a 15 site system. Yeah? So in many regimes, this is actually pretty good and you exactly know what you're doing with an actual error bar to what's going on.
That's probably true, but there's no scaling at such short distance scale.
Yeah, well, you know, I'm not saying that. Yeah. Yeah.
It's only dependent on where you stop. It's not universal at all.
Indeed. Yeah. Totally. Yeah.
Therefore,
yeah, indeed.
But that's okay.
That's, of course, not the claim. The claim is not that, that's also not what you find. The thing is that you do find not universality. Why? Because, well, maybe you do not expect universality because, it's not, you're not necessarily in the universal regime, which is what nobody claims. Well, the thing is, okay, good. Then I come to the point that indeed you find power laws. Yeah? You are not really in the regime where you expect a universal dynamics at all, but you're in a setting where you very precisely understand what's going on in 1D, and you do find a power law, just very different ones from the.
For which range?
For a very large range, for orders of magnitude In over the quench, you do find a power law, except a different one from the one that's predicted in the Kibble-Zurich setting. You may say, well, you're not universal. Sure, right? That might be, but you do find a power law, but over orders of magnitude, but a different one, and one that depends. That's also very much smaller than the prediction of Kibble-Zurich, but also one that depends very much on how deep you go into the superfluid at the end,
yes,
but over orders of magnitude, yes.
Can you tell us what is measuring the experiment?
Oh, it's all correlation lengths. They make a quench, you fit correlation lengths at the final setting. It's all about function of the correlation length as a function of the quench time. Yeah? So this is the thing. I'm not saying that's universal, because it's surely not, but I'm saying that you go into the lab, you can find out in 1D what's going on, and you do find a power law, just a very different one from what you would expect from a Kibble-Zurich setting. And this is kind of that's the point in the quantum simulation mind that I'm trying to make here, is that I'm not saying it's universal, but I know you can go into the lab and can check, and what comes out is this kind of power law of different orders of magnitude. That works for 1D. You can precisely know what's going on. You can check. You do find power laws, which are different from this naive reading of a Kibble-Zurich picture. But you, of course, can also go in 2D and 3D. That's a very simple change of the experiment, in that you just change the confinement in the other directions. And then, again, you find coefficients that are much lower than the ones of the Kibble-Zurich prediction. But again, you find power laws over orders of magnitude. But now you can no longer keep track of that. No, I have not 15 sites. No. It's like, it's similar order. It's like 70 sites or so. The 15 sites was for the cross-check with exact decodization. Of course, the full model is a full setting with all sites, and it's a larger system. Yeah. But it's just for certain settings, if the correlation lengths are short enough, it's a great cross-check to be precisely sure what's going on. Yeah? Yes, that's correct. Yeah.
How well are the equilibrium explained in characters? Is it clear where the steering region is? How close you need to go to?
Yeah, you can say a lot about this. I mean, indeed. I mean, the chairman is already sitting here. The equilibrium properties are quite nicely understood, right? And this, of course, is also cross-checked against that. Like, we know. This is what we know. We compare that with Monte Carlo data and also with ground state data. Costless, doubtless point. Indeed. The Kibble-Zurich setting would be one, but you're right, there was a kind of costless, doubtless point in 1D, but in more than 1D, there's no costless, doubtless point. There's the critical exponents are well defined, and then again, you would have values of the critical exponents in 2D and 3D, and again, you find the power law over orders of magnitude, but a different one from the Kibble-Zurich setting. Also, if you're not at the you would expect a logarithmic correction, it's not divergent, but you would get a logarithmic correction to the one power law setting. You're right. In this sense, it's a bit special. Yeah. So the mindset I wanted to get across here is that one does find power laws, but they're different from the naive reading. And it's not that you're universal. I never said this, because presumably you're not. It's just saying that there's more to say than there's a lot to say about this still. It's not so easy to find good conditions to know when you're really close to the point, although one can say some things. And here the point is that you can kind of go into the lab and just test the question under precisely controlled conditions. You can cross-check, and then you can also look at experiments in 2D, 3D, alternative scales, and so on, which are no longer accessible with classical computers. 53 minutes into the talk, I have a summary and some musings. So, okay. I summarize, and the musings I might cut. This talk was concerned with equilibration and thermalization in several ways, and a bit of a twist on quantum simulations actually probing these questions in settings where the theorems that we mentioned no longer capture things. We took a question of equilibration, then the question of thermalization. Do systems go to a setting where the Gibbs ensembles come about? You can think of experimental fast quenches. I showed in what way you find fast quench equilibration properties that in a way outperform classical computers, and that's kind of the crime story of slow quenches, where you can measure things, but one has to be careful with the interpretation of the result, but one can be very careful that one knows what's going on in the lab, and one can probe the thing under precisely controlled conditions in the lab, and this is the point, and not that universality comes out, but just that you can go into the lab and probe the question, you know what's going on. So, in a way, there's evidence that these devices that you have in the lab can do something that, in a way, outperform classical supercomputers. Of course, one should be careful here. This is a kind of a baby step in this direction. But as I said, the setting that we have here in the lab are the smoking gun candidates of trying to do something in the lab that you can no longer do efficiently on a classical computer. So achieve what John Preskill called quantum supremacy, semi-jokingly, on his blog some time ago. So to realize something in the lab, given that quantum computers are a difficult thing to build, of having something in the lab that you can quite nicely control, but still do something, solve something that for which you have good reasons to believe that you cannot really do that on a classical computer. Yeah, and I'm not saying that this is achieved fully, but it's a kind of this type of smoking gun system where it's a great arena to look at that type of system. Can I think of complexity classes? Well, I will cut that short and will rather swallow that. I have one outlook question on certification, but do you want to hear this? Maybe I cut this. Yeah?
Yes.
Okay. I have an ironic twist at the end. It's a bit of a quantum information-y. It's not so much. It's a kind of a very basic setting. If you think that's a bit off, judge for yourself. But it's just saying that this question of having a device in the lab that does something hard and checking whether you're doing the right thing, it's a very intricate and very intertwined thing. And I just tell you two things and you judge for yourself. First, this is a baby version of a bosonic setting. It's called boson sampling, where one sends bosons into a multiport and just samples from the output distribution that you get out at the end of the day. It's like a quantum Galton board, okay? You set it in, you get it, and you sample from the output distribution. Now, you can do it in the lab, but there's strong evidence that you cannot simulate the same distribution on a classical computer, or you can not approximate that to a constant error in one norm unless the polynomial hierarchy collapses, meaning you cannot do it on the classical computer. So experimentalists thought, great, we can have a device in the lab that you can do with present technology that presumably does something that you cannot do classically efficiently. So unsurprisingly, all the usual suspects, leading quantum opticians, went to the lab and did that experiment and published in Science, Nature, Nature Physics, Nature Photonics, and or other papers. So yeah, that was the one thing. That's the one observation. The other observation that's true at the same time, where there's some mathematical conditions in that are not proven, but there's strong evidence that this is the case. At the same time, there's strong evidence for the following, that you cannot classically efficiently certify that you have the right thing. Meaning, I can take my iPhone, where is it here? I can put it into a box, program that iPhone, close it, and give you the device and claim I have a boson sampler that's outperforming all classical computers, and you probably have no way of distinguishing that device from the actual boson sampler. These are mathematically both true at the same time. So presumably it's doing something powerful, more powerful than classically. At the same time, you cannot find out whether you've done it efficiently, and it will look like one that you could have done also classically efficiently, unless you open the box, of course. But there are settings where you have a device and that is doing something that looks for all purposes that you could be interested in, just like one that I could have done on my iPhone. So in what way would it be really more powerful than a classical computer? That's an extreme ironic twist. What does it say? I'm out of time, I'm not saying you, judge for yourself. But it does ask interesting question about what quantum simulation is, how much hardness of quantum simulation and certification of finding out whether you've done the right thing are intricately intertwined, and ask very interesting questions about what a quantum simulation is at the end of the day. Thank you very much for your attention.
Yeah. Well, there's one
Yeah, yeah.
Per mark, and then sort of one.
Yeah, yeah.
No, it's really great to hear a lot about a little and a little about a lot.
Yeah.
And towards the end, I guess we hear somewhat about something, which is good too.
Yeah, yeah. That's a great summary. Thank you.
No, but it does seem like, you know, the classical computers are particularly pathetic when one's trying to integrate time event Schrodinger equation for
yeah.
a long time.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It just gets very entangled. And on the other hand, things presumably simplify at some level because they become very random as well.
Yeah.
And so I'm just wondering, are there, you know, different approaches which are, you know, not brute force that one can try to develop? Or maybe we should be asking different questions. You know, I'm not trying to, I don't know what those questions are necessarily,
yep.
but it's just more just a, you know, throw out a comment to, you know, to the feelings of discouragement one might get in, you know, seeing the classical computers pathetically poop out of it.
Yeah, yeah. But also, I'm not very negative about it. I think this is a, I mean, it's a positive perspective that you can find some things in some regimes. You can prove some things in some regimes. I gave some examples. And then there are other settings for which there's evidence that you cannot do them, although there's a lot to be done that you cannot do them. Right? And then there may be one remark also that whenever you do something in the lab, I mean, nature is also forgiving often. Things that you actually observe are often easier than what computer scientists would call a worst-case instance. So even if you show that something is NP-hard or so, that doesn't mean that you cannot do it. For example, cooling a system is QMA complete, but take your pizza, put it into the fridge, it's getting pretty cold. Although the general pizza problem may be QMA-hard, but you see what I mean. Yeah. Having said that, even these seemingly simple questions that I mentioned, like look at non-equilibrium dynamics of a many-body system, that can be... There's good evidence that this is very hard because one should not think that, oh, it's a simple plot. You can maybe think of a Dublin-Holland picture that captures some of the physics thereof. But you would have some prescription that takes the input of the experimental specification and spits out the right output for all of these inputs. You won't have a kind of like a function that does it. And that can be very hard. So lesson, I don't know. But there's good evidence that there's this arena of intermediate times where you cannot do things classically, and that's a good thing. Yeah? Well, but it's more to say. Yeah?
Maybe one thing about when things become really entangled and entanglement entropy scales as a volume is it's complicated, but actually we don't care because there is no measurement we can actually make to really measure this ever. Not even an experiment we can measure. So the only things we can measure are really classical coarse grain quantities that follow hydrodynamics.
Oh, I'm not sure I agree.
No.
This is not true.
Yeah,
okay. Oh, no, this is not true. I mean, no.
That's a historical fact.
Yeah.
I mean, this is not, well, I mean, this kind of, the truth is probably in the middle somewhere, in that, of course, in many settings, you do measure like averages or things that for which there's good reason to believe that there's a kind of hydrodynamic picture or some sort of semi-classical picture that works. But of course, with even translation and many-body dynamics, you can do very intricate things. And there are even settings where they are almost as powerful as provably as powerful as a quantum computer. So there's a regime which presumably is accessible in the lab where you cannot do it. So to exactly flesh out the regime is the smoking gun that's our task.
I want to make it more precise. So yeah. You showed this.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, yeah. Your
computer could actually simulate it as long as it was oscillating. And then you couldn't simulate it when it was flat.
No, this is not, yeah.
Now, the experiment shows a flat plot. So now, what else would you like to measure there that you think would give you information about this, I mean, meaningful information about this state?
Yeah, well, this is not quite true what you say, because of course, I mean, this is, well, one should be optimistic and pessimistic about it. It's optimistic and pessimistic in the sense that these are a bit kindergarten-like things. Like, of course, you want to have a more flexible setting, more control, more, like, longer times and so on. Okay, that's the bad news. The good news is that you're not right in that you can do it until it's flat. You can do it to some point, and there's a big, tricky regime in the middle, and then for very long times, again, you may be able to judge stuff, and there's even some proven regimes, I mean, in this case, a trivial that you get with 1/2, and you can even prove that this eventually approaches that value. But there's a regime in the middle that you cannot do on with any of these approaches. And this is pretty serious numerics, and you can Like, you can make pretty serious claims on how much you can capture with any, say, tensor network-related approach to capture these dynamics. So in this sense, it's rather serious, right? Of course, it would be good to have a more complicated picture, I agree, right? And the second example that I showed is a more sophisticated example of that type, where you do not quite know what's going on because, well, as you say, it might not be universal, but you can see what's going on in a kind of quantum simulation. That's a more sophisticated property because you can really probe stuff over an entire range of parameters. I think this is a fair next kindergarten step. These are small steps, but I mean, come on. That's the type of thing that you want to do if you ever want to realize something in the lab for which there's good hope that you are outperforming classical computers. That's not happening with four photons in the lab, despite all the Nature papers about it.
Okay, so let's thank the speaker.
Thanks for the interest.